From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic Jonathan Yardley has just written a family memoir. On this edition of Fresh Air, Yardley talks with us about writing reviews and getting reviewed. Also, we hear how Little Anthony and the Imperials made the transition from doo-wop to orchestral production on part two of our interview with Little Anthony. And we have reviews of the new jazz album from Connie Crothers and Lenny Popkin, and of the rebroadcast of NBC's 1960 production of Peter Pan starring Mary Martin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest, Jonathan Yardley, is a book critic and columnist for The Washington Post. In 1981, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Criticism. Now the book critic is awaiting reviews of his own new book, a family memoir called Our Kind of People. It's a portrait of his parents, Bill and Helen Yardley. For 20 years, Bill Yardley was the headmaster of Chatham Hill, a Virginia boarding school for girls. Jonathan grew up in the school rectory with his brother and two sisters. Our Kind of People was favorably reviewed in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Elizabeth Janeway described it as both a private act of piety and a public inquiry into the social history of the American minority known as WASPs. Janeway writes, "Out of lived experience and inherited legend, Yardley has made a fine book about all kinds of people." Yardley is also the author of a biography of Ring Lardner. I asked him if there are awkward moments for a book critic when their own book is reviewed.
Well, yes, because you've been on one side of the fence for your entire career, although in my case I did publish one book a dozen years ago. To suddenly be on the receiving end after being on the giving end is a strange phenomenon. I think that because you are a professional book reviewer, you're peculiarly sensitive to the way the business has been done and to the sort of the undercurrents of a book review. So I think you could say in candor that I've been watching the book review pages with unusual interest lately.
It must be tricky for book review editors to decide who should review you, because you've reviewed so many people that a lot of people would feel they owed you a favor, and a lot of other people would probably want to get even for a bad review.
That's exactly right, and I have seen five or six reviews of my book so far, and I'm relieved and pleased to say that they've all been favorable, and very few of them have been by people that I would have naturally thought of as prospective reviewers, so it suggests to me that book editors have been aware of this problem and have been thinking about it in a sensitive and productive way.
Does it give you a different sense of book reviewing to read reviews of your own work?
It makes you very much aware of how much a review of one's work can elevate or depress you. I'm a tough reviewer, and I will confess that in awaiting for the bad review that sooner or later is going to come of this book, I've thought of some of those those writers that I've been tough on, and I wouldn't change my judgments, not in a minute, but I sympathize with them more as human beings, perhaps, than I did when I wrote the reviews.
Well, let's talk about your new book, Our Kind of People. It's a memoir. It's the story of your parents, really, and through telling your parents' story, you also tell the story of other members of your family. This book started from you finding a cabinet of letters written by your parents. How did you find them?
Well, not long after my mother's death in the fall of 1986, I was visiting my father at their retirement cottage in Rhode Island. And my father was not in good physical or mental condition, and I had taken care of him, and he actually had a housekeeper, and she was putting him to bed. And I was sitting in the dining room and quite accidentally opened this little wooden file cabinet that I'd been aware of virtually all of my life, and it had always been locked. And there it opened up, and inside were very tightly packed 12 inches of letters, financial documents, health records, and other papers. I had seen family papers in the past, copies of my father's letters and other things, but I'd never seen them in so concentrated a dose. And I started reading through them that night, and I realized that here, with extraordinary detail, was the record of a 50-year marriage, and of parenthood and professional life and everything else. And I got to thinking that perhaps I could tell. I didn't think it then. It was a couple of months before it began to sink in. But slowly over a period of time, I began to feel that I had here the documentation to tell the story of the lives of some fairly ordinary middle-class American people. Not famous, not wealthy, not prominent. And it occurred to me that this was a story that might make connections with the lives of other fairly ordinary people. Whether that is in effect has happened, I don't really know. My parents were also white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and that enters into it. This is a story about the fading WASP culture and the kinds of people and convictions and traditions that it fostered.
I think one of the things that interests me the most about your book is your exercise in trying to find your parents' lives, the part of their lives that had nothing to do with the role of parenting.
Right.
We all know our parents as mother and father, mom and dad, but you tried to find what it is about your parents separate from their role as parents.
Well, there were two things I was trying to do there. First of all, I don't think I'm a particularly interesting person. I don't think I'd led a particularly interesting life that is interesting to anybody except me. And it never crossed my mind that a memoir of my own life would be of interest to anybody at all. So in thinking about this, the first thing I tried to do was to get myself out of the story as much as possible, except for certain places in which my appearance is unavoidable. The other thing was that I was 46 or 7 when I started working on this, started thinking about it, which is just about the same age as my parents were when they were in the prime of their lives. And I've had this, you know, I've had different experiences from theirs, but I've had children, I've had good moments and bad. I think matured into a reasonably adult person. And it occurred to me that I might be able to look through my own experience to see them as real people, not as parents. You know, parenthood is obviously tremendously important to all of those of us who are fortunate enough to be parents, but it's not the only thing we do in our lives, and it's our children tend to think that it is. And I tried to step back from my parents and to see them in whole.
You've even called them Bill and Helen in the book instead of mother and father.
Yes, I think that was very important. This was a way of saying to the reader that this is their book, not mine. And I think if every sentence had the phrase my mother or my father or my mother and my father, that I would have been intruding in there, even if I didn't mention myself, on every single line of the book, and I didn't want that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Yardley, book critic for The Washington Post and author of a new memoir about his parents called Our Kind of People. Well, you keep saying that you don't think you're interesting enough to sustain a book, and you've taken yourself out of this memoir as much as possible. But I'm going to focus in for a moment on the section that you are prominently featured in. And this is the section where your father and mother have decided to send you to Groton, to the prep school. And I should point out here that your father was the rector of a girls' boarding school, or a girls' school that was partly a boarding school, in Virginia called Chatham Hall. You were something of a troublemaker at Groton, and the head of the school sent a letter complaining about your behavior to your father, and your father wrote a letter in response that I'd like for you to read.
It was on one of the numerous occasions when John Crocker, the head of Groton School, was on the verge of kicking me out, and my father responded to him as follows. It is easy to see what sort of boy Johnny must be at school. We have girls of that sort at Chatham Hall. They may not actually commit open crimes, but they nibble at the foundations of what the school is supposed to do. I am mortified that my son finds himself in this undistinguished company and pays back for his scholarship by unconstructive attitudes. Helen and I think that your talk with him was wonderful and that he is really determined to do well for the rest of the year. If you feel that he would be detrimental as a senior and does not deserve the chance, by all means act according to your best judgment. Do let me beg of you, however, to let us know as early as possible if you decide he should not return. It is very hard to get a boy into a halfway decent school for his final year, especially if he has been dropped by a first-class one. Let me beg of you, too, to follow him along a little bit and to lay it on the line in no uncertain terms. He has personally great respect for you, a respect colored by affection and a respect heightened by your conversation of December. It seems to me that education is a redemptive as well as a condemning process, and that we school people do not always solve our problems just by getting rid of them. I have got rid of many by the process you suggest for Johnny, and these children that I have dropped have stayed much longer on my conscience than the problems we kept and continued to work on.
What were your feelings when you first came across this letter and saw the trouble that you were making for your
father?
Oh,
I knew all along I was making trouble for my parents. Uh-huh. They were not shy about letting me know that. What really hit me then was in seeing all of this on paper was to see the strategies, which were really rather subtle, that my father had adopted in order to improve my chances of staying the course at Groton. There's an odd mixture of obsequiousness and pride in that letter, begging Crocker on the one hand to give me every possible chance, and on the other being very stern with Crocker about saying, look, you can't use the school to shape this boy into what you think he ought to be. You've got to help him discover himself. Education is a redemptive as well as a punitive process.
Writing a book about your parents and seeing this letter from their perspective, did you wish that at the time you were more careful about causing trouble for your parents?
Oh, no. I mean, life goes on as it uh-huh. goes. And, you know, it's I don't regret anything. I don't really have important regrets about anything in my life. All of us are going to have bad patches, and unfortunately, you can't have a bad patch all by yourself. Other people are going to be affected by it. I was very lucky that my parents, my mother in particular, were compassionate and kind to me when it really mattered. They were very, very frustrated, my father in particular, because he was himself a private school man. My misbehavior, which is really what it was, and my immaturity, which is certainly what it was, were very vexing to him. And he was very good with girls, but this difficult boy that he had was his oldest child, he couldn't always understand me, and he could be very impatient with me. And of course, I'm sorry for the grief I caused him at the time, but he and I ended up liking each other a good deal and as adults. And fathers and sons and mothers go through that.
What form did your rebelliousness take?
Well, I never have liked being in the classroom. I don't think that the schoolroom is the right place to learn, and not that I can offer you a better one. And I was very rebellious. My parents were inside, outside in the world of American privilege and prominence. They were old WASPs with a decent history running back into the country's early beginnings, but they never had any money together, and they worked for people who had a lot of money, who sent their daughters to Chatham Hall School and to other schools that my father had worked for previously. So I grew up with some resentments against people of privilege and money, and I think that I gave vent to them in a generally surly behavior for much of the time I was at Groton School, I was a bad boy. I had what schools like that call a bad attitude.
Your parents were very much involved with passing on certain values, the value of education, and the values of how to be. How to live properly? Is that the right way of putting it?
Well, I think so, yeah. How to live a life that isn't so completely self-absorbed and that somehow has some meaning and value for other people.
And, you know, running a school, they had to inculcate these values not only in their children but in all the other parents' children that they were entrusted with. I wonder if that was handed down to you, if you as an adult feel also this sense of obligation in passing on certain values?
Well, that's a good question. Some friend of mine, a year or two ago, before I'd completed work on this book, I was telling him what I was doing and mentioning that my father had been a preacher of sorts, and he said, well, you know, you're a preacher of sorts too, and I think there's an element of truth to that. I don't work in the kind of people-centered environment that my father did. I work by myself in my study in my house in Baltimore doing book reviews on a weekly column that tends to be about social and cultural matters. And I'm sort of up there in my pulpit telling the world what I think. And I think of it as a way to give voice to the things that I believe in and the traditions that I hold to be valuable. And it's not, I think, as important a human activity as being a teacher, but it is a form of the same sort of thing.
My guest is Jonathan Yardley, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning book critic with The Washington Post and author of a new memoir about his parents called Our Kind of People. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jonathan Yardley, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about book reviewing, and to kick off this chapter of our conversation, I'd like for you to read an excerpt of a letter that you reprint in your new memoir about your parents, Our Kind of People. And this is a letter from the head of the Groton School, the prep school that you attended, to your father, and it's about your behavior, and it's an analysis of you as a reader of books.
Well, this was in 1956, I guess. Yes, in the spring of 56. And once again, Groton School had been right on the edge of kicking me out, and once again, somehow or other, I had avoided the ultimate peril. And Crocker wrote to my father to say, "Johnny has made sufficient progress to enable us to make a favorable decision as regards his return next year." And then he went on, "It would be unrealistic to suppose that all his difficulties have been resolved. He is still a boy who lacks intellectual discipline. He reads a lot, but he reads superficially. And I hope very much that next year he will greatly increase his capacity to get the real substance out of a superior book. Incidentally, I hope that before long he will reach a stage of maturity beyond his present strong appetite for comic books."
Oh, who would have suspected? Well, how was that assessment? Do you think it was an accurate assessment?
Oh, absolutely.
For the time?
I think it was a little bit simplistic, but it took me a while to learn how to read a book right. And in those years, I wanted to read everything, and I was probably reading everything too hastily and not getting enough out of it.
Do you still read comic books?
I haven't seen a comic book for so long, I don't know what they look like anymore.
Okay. Let's talk about book reviewing. The first thing I want to ask you is about constructing a good book review and the function a good book review serves. And I'll mention here that there's a kind of book review that really drives me crazy. I call it the book report, mm-hmm. where the book reviewer sums up the story of the book, and this could be fiction or nonfiction, and then there's one equivocal sentence at the end
right.
in which you're trying to make out, does this mean they like it or not?
I think of those as the Time and Newsweek sort of book reviews. The magazines are better about that than they used to be, but it used to be that a book review in Time just consisted of a summary of what was inside the book with a sentence perhaps saying that this was a good book.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I hate those too. Let me offer the qualification that there is a certain kind of book review that performs a very valuable function, and that is a book review that takes the ideas or the information in a relatively arcane book, say on a book dealing with some new discoveries in science or some new social trends, a book that is not going to be widely read because it's difficult or obscure or whatever, but that contains important ideas. A book review, an intelligent book review that can encapsulate those ideas into 800 or 1,000 words and make them comprehensible to a serious general reader is a very valuable thing. Because that's probably the only way that those readers will ever encounter those ideas. But as a general rule, I think that it is a very valuable rule of thumb to tell as little about a book's contents as you can in order to describe the book to the reader.
And you think it's important, too, to state clearly what your impressions of the book are?
Absolutely. I mean, as in most things in life, books do not come in black and white. They tend to fall in varying shades of gray, so that in any book you are going to find some good things and some bad things, and I think more often than not book reviews, like everything else, are mixed. But that doesn't mean you have to equivocate. You can be strongly opinionated in saying this is what I really like about this book and this is where the author has failed.
I know those of us who work on Fresh Air are always in the position of going through books before we decide who our guests are going to be to see if we think that this book is worthy of an interview with the author.
Mm-hmm.
What's your technique for going through a book, not to review it, but to see if it's worthy of review?
Well, you know, I don't really work that way. I tend to make decisions on what books I will review before I've sat down with the book. I very, very rarely sit down with a set of bound galley proofs and read it and then say, oh, well, gee, I think I'll review this. It's much more a case of going through publishers' catalogs, of going through press releases, of seeing galley proofs that come in. You know, I've been doing this for 20 or 25 years, and I know who the experienced authors are whose work interests me. I know the subjects, the general subjects in nonfiction that I feel competent to review. I know books, what books each season are likely to be newsworthy. And if you work for a newspaper, as I do, and write book reviews for it, newsworthiness is an important consideration. I also have books suggested to me as possible items for review by members of the Washington Post's Book World staff. Sometimes I'm quite disappointed. I will commit myself 2 months in advance to reviewing a novel that looks particularly interesting for one reason or another, and I get to it and it isn't. But the reasons that made me go to it in the first place are likely to be strong enough so that the review still should be written. That is to say, this is an author whose work is interesting, or a subject that's interesting, or whatever. And even if the book disappoints me a great deal, I still think that that's a judgment that ought to be rendered.
About how many books do you have to review a week?
Well, I do 2 book reviews a week, and each is usually 1 book. Sometimes I double up, but I figure I review about 100 books a year.
How much time can you devote to reading each of the books that you review? Do you have time to actually read them?
Oh, yes.
Read them slowly?
Well, you know, I think that a book dictates the pace at which it's read. I am fully capable of reading a 600-page novel in a day if there's nothing particularly deep or arresting about the book. You know, a book that's the so-called proverbial good read, I can get through that very fast, at the rate of 100 pages an hour. And, I'm taking in what I need to take in, and the review that I write will be competent and fair. But on the other hand, you can get a 150-page book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that's densely written, densely argued, or that's so wonderful that you don't want to rush through it. And that 150-page book can take me a day, too. There really are no... I set aside... For the 2 books I review each week, I set aside 2 days. I read on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I write my book reviews on Thursday, and I write my column on Friday. And Mondays, I'm in the Washington Post at a meeting. And 2 days, ordinarily, is plenty of time for me to read 2 books. And if it's not enough time, I make time. I have no objection to working on weekends if I need to do that. I'm going to be sitting down this week to read for the first time in 25 or 30 years The Grapes of Wrath, which has its 50th anniversary this spring. And that's a long book, and there's a little book, about 200-page book, of Steinbeck's notebooks on The Grapes of Wrath, and I'm going to be reviewing those together. I really very much doubt that I'll get through those in a day. That doesn't bother me. I'll allocate whatever time is necessary to do the job properly.
I'm sure following books as carefully as you do, that you always see patterns emerging about the kind of material being published, or themes that emerge over a large body of work. Do you see that happening now, or the patterns that you see in the publishing world
now?
Well,
I'm very worried about American literary fiction right now. I'm concerned that the schools of creative writing on the college campuses are isolating literary writers from real American life and are producing sort of cookie-cutter novelists whose books seem to me to have an astonishing isolation from life as most Americans actually live it. We see this the good sort of upper-middle-brow fiction that people read when my parents were alive and reading by writers like Irwin Shaw and John Marquand and even Scott Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe, people whom we now think of substantial American literary figures. That kind of book that is connected with American daily life, you don't find that anywhere in this country in our literature now, except in pop fiction, bestseller-type fiction. The so-called serious American fiction is very navel-gazing and self-conscious and almost hostile to the general, serious general reader. I find that a very, very disturbing development, because if literary American fiction becomes inward gazing, then if it doesn't look at any world except itself, then it's not going to connect with the world, and it'll eventually die on the vine.
I think some of the most interesting writing is happening in memoirs right now. You've just written one. I wonder what you think of that. I'm sure you've been reading
memoirs. I've read Tobias's book.
Tobias Wolfe.
This boy's life, and I liked it. I particularly liked a book by Eva Hoffman called mm-hmm. Lost in Translation, and there are one or two others that I have not read Carl Bernstein's book, and there are one or two others I haven't written. My editor, John Herman at Weidenfeld and Nicholson, told me not so long ago that he thinks that the most interesting American writing is being done in nonfiction rather than in fiction, and I at the risk of being self-serving or sounding self-serving, I think that there's more than a small grain of truth to that.
Are there books recently where you found that you've taken a very unpopular stand? Different from...
Well, I didn't like the Satanic Verses. My review of it appeared long before the furor over poor Rushdie's death sentence arose. I thought it was a tangled, self-indulgent, imitative, showy sort of book, and I have to tell you that although heaven knows my sympathy for Rushdie is absolute, my literary judgment of the book has not changed one iota, and I have sensed that a lot of people whose motives may or may not be pure, I guess it varies from individual to individual, who are so anxious to show their sympathy for Rushdie are making the mistake of confusing the author's plight with the literary quality of the book itself. Of course, the possibility that I am wrong is out there, as it always is, and I very often am wrong. But in this case, I've talked with a great many people about the Satanic Verses. I don't know anybody who's finished it.
Are there any book reviews you wish you could rewrite and reconsider your opinion?
Yeah, I don't think I will be kind and not mention any specifics because there's no reason in singling out a very small handful of people. But by and large, they are books that I think I overpraised in the past. Books that came along on sort of a great rush of excitement, and I got caught up with them. I was younger then, and I'm probably more susceptible to that kind of temptation than I am now. I don't go out of my way to go against the grain, but I'm much more skeptical than I used to be about the kind of groundswell that builds up in publishing over such and such a book. And there are some very, very favorable reviews that I still see bouncing back at me in quotes on paperback dust jackets that I wish I hadn't written. I cannot think offhand of an unfavorable review I've written that I wished I had been kinder or more favorable.
Mm-hmm.
I write, you know, I read on Tuesday and Wednesday, as I say, and I write on Thursday. There isn't an awful lot of time, obviously, for reflection. It's not much different from the theater critic who goes to the performance at 8 and gets back to the office at 11 and has his copy in by midnight. There's not much time for the luxury of prolonged meditation and reflection that the so-called literary critic has. Given that you don't have much time, you're going to make mistakes. And given that most work isn't very good, the mistakes tend to be to get too excited about something that seems more wonderful than it really is. That, at least to me, is the principal problem I face.
When you go on vacation, do you enjoy taking a book with you, or do you
yes,
give yourself a break?
Yes, I do. I went through a few summers when I couldn't stand to have a busman's holiday, but last summer I took the Library of America, Edith Wharton, and I took some Theodore Dreiser, and I took some Josephine Tay, and I guess what you could say is I took really, really good books to the beach and didn't have to worry about reviewing them, and I just had the time of my life. I hadn't read all of the Wharton and Dreiser, who are writers I admire enormously, and this was a real treat for me. After reading a lot of mediocre books by people who are grinding them out now, it was a real joy to read something that had lasted for a long time.
Well, Jonathan Yardley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your new book and about reviewing books. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Jonathan Yardley's new memoir about his parents, Our Kind of People, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. His columns and book reviews are published by The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk about glasnost and perestroika with Bill and Jane Taubman. They're both professors at Amherst College who are also specialists in Soviet affairs and are frequent visitors to the Soviet Union. They were living in Moscow when Gorbachev first began his reforms. The Taubman's new book, Moscow Spring, looks at the significance of those reforms. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Little Anthony is no longer singing with the Imperials, but he's reviving his singing career. Coming up on part two of our interview, Little Anthony tells us about recording his hits from the 60s, songs like Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop and Hurt So Bad. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from pianist Connie Crothers and tenor saxophonist Lenny Popkin, two musicians who studied with the late pianist-composer Lenny Tristano. And NBC is rebroadcasting its 1960 production of Peter Pan, starring Mary Martin. Television critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm. The Arena Party has defeated the incumbent Christian Democratic Party in presidential elections yesterday in El Salvador. Christian Democratic candidate Fidel Chavez Mena today conceded defeat to Alfredo Cristiani. The State Department today urged the newly elected government of El Salvador to commit itself to democracy and respect for human rights. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Salvadoran elections took place at a time when Congress is beginning to take a second look at American policy there, largely because of the rise of the right-wing Arena Party, which won yesterday's presidential elections. The Arena Party's most popular leader, Roberto Dabuzon, has been linked to the rightist death squads. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said today the outgoing administration of José Napoleón Duarte was committed to democracy and human rights, and the State Department would hold the Arena Party to the same standard.
As I've said before, our relationship with the new government will depend on its adherence to democracy and respect for human rights. Those have been the twin pillars of our approach toward El Salvador.
Capitol Hill staffers say Arena's human rights performance will influence current congressional support for the Salvadoran government. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Nearly 300 people were arrested around the country in sometimes violent protests today against U.S. support for the government of El Salvador as demonstrators scuffled with police, blocked traffic, and kept federal workers from their offices. Nine police officers suffered minor injuries, and several demonstrators received cuts and bruises during clashes at a protest outside the federal building in New York City. The Supreme Court today cleared the way for a partial merger of Detroit's two daily newspapers. The court, over two dissenting votes, set aside an earlier postponement that had been granted by Justice William Brennan. A federal appeals court panel in Detroit voted 2-1 last January to uphold an attorney general's decision to allow the newspapers to form a joint operating agreement under the Federal Newspaper Preservation Act. The Supreme Court also agreed to decide whether individuals have a constitutional right to use the hallucinogenic drug peyote in religious ceremonies. The case involves two Native Americans from Oregon. Alan Support of member station KLCC has details.
The two men were fired by the state of Oregon for using peyote as part of a religious ceremony. Last year, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in their favor. The state high court said the constitutional protection of religious freedom bars the state from denying unemployment compensation to the two men. But Oregon Attorney General Dave Frohnmayer believes individual states should have the right to outlaw drugs. Frohnmayer says there are numerous cases in other states where addictive drugs have been claimed to be part of religious ceremonies.
Marijuana, heroin, cocaine. And this is obviously a place where some very careful lines have to be drawn about what's a legitimate religious belief, and on the other hand, what kind of action can a state make criminal on the basis that it's bad for the entire population.
The court's decision, expected sometime next October, also likely will resolve whether any state may criminally prosecute someone for the religious use of peyote. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Saporin in Eugene.
Coast Guard officials say two oil rigs exploded and are still burning off New Orleans today. At least 10 crewmen were injured. 7 are still missing. The rigs are owned by the Atlantic Richfield Company. Coast Guard Petty Officer Bob Moorhead said an oil slick has formed in the Gulf of Mexico about 2 miles long and 100 yards wide. Flight attendants have called for a strike against Continental Airlines. After working for 5.5 years without a contract, there have been few signs of disruption so far, but union officials claim the strike will grow. Continental is owned by Texas Air, which also owns Eastern. That airline's in bankruptcy after a strike there. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 29 points to close at 2262.50. Declines led advances 4-1 on volume of 151 million shares. The average price of a share lost 31 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Connie Crothers and saxophonist Lenny Popkin both were influenced by the late pianist and composer Lenny Tristano, who died in 1978. Crothers studied with Tristano for well over a decade. Popkin was also his student and produced a couple of posthumous Tristano albums. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by Crothers and Popkin. He says they learned their lessons well.
That's pianist Connie Crothers and tenor saxophonist Lenny Popkin playing a line by their mentor, pianist Lenny Tristano. Tristano's music was a matter of cool surfaces, long and undulating lines that go on forever, a lean, pale saxophone sound, and low-key timekeeping from bass and drums. His influence is so pervasive on a new album by the Crothers-Popkin Quartet, Love Energy, on the New Artists label, that you can't talk about them without talking about him. The record leads off with Lenny Popkin's tribute, LT. That tune reveals this album's main weakness, melodies that snake up and down rather predictably. But Crothers and Popkin remember one aspect of Tristano's music other disciples forget, the heat and passion lurking beneath the cool facade. Here's the last minute of Soul in Minor. The most low-key piece on the album is a version of Irving Berlin's How Deep is the Ocean. Pianist Crothers starts improvising from the opening bars without stating the melody. She could have just given the piece a new name and claimed it as her own, as jazz musicians do. But the title, How Deep is the Ocean, sets the tone for the performance's oceanic drift. Everything moves in slow motion, like life underwater. The quartet's bassist is Cameron Brown, who also studied with Lenny Tristano. On drums is Carol Tristano, Lenny's daughter. Brown is a fine and underrated bassist, best known for his work in smoking bands like the George Adams Don Pullen Quartet. He's one ex-student whose playing doesn't proclaim his pedigree, though it does reflect his teacher's linear sense. Tristano liked his rhythm sections to be subservient to the front line. Crothers and Popkin give their rhythm players room to make their own statements. It's one way they improve on the original. Lenny Tristano's disciples often say he helped them find themselves musically, yet most of them make music strikingly like his. One critic I know compares her approach to that of ghost bands, swing orchestras like Glenn Miller's that carry on long after a leader's death. But Tristano's legacy deserves to live on, and Crothers and Popkin are well qualified to preserve it. They've internalized his concepts so thoroughly, their music rarely seems secondhand.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Love Energy, a new album by the Connie Crothers Lenny Popkin Quartet on the New Artists label. This is Fresh Air. On the last Fresh Air, Anthony Gourdin told us he's been out on his own ever since Little Anthony and the Imperials broke up in 1975. He has a solo singing career and has also done some acting. Right now, he's singing contemporary songs, standards, and some of his old hits at an extended run at the Ballroom in New York. Little Anthony and the Imperials' hits included Tears on My Pillow, Going Out of My Head, Hurt So Bad, I'm on the Outside, and Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop. In part two of our conversation, we look back at the making of some of those records.
Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa bop, shimmy, shimmy, bop. Shimmy, shimmy, cocoa bop, shimmy, shimmy, bop. Sitting in a native hut all alone in blue. Sitting in a native hut wondering what to do. Along came a native girl, did a native dance. It was like in paradise, put me in a trance. Going shimmy, shimmy, cocoa bop, shimmy, shimmy, bop.
Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop was Little Anthony's second hit, recorded in 1960. I asked him how he felt about recording a novelty song.
I hated it. I think the song is dumb. I still do. What is a Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop? We didn't even know what it was. But George Goldner was a very persuasive man. For one reason, he was the president of the company, and we had to do what he told us to do. And he, you know, he leaned on us a little bit, so to speak, and told us we're going to record that, whether we like it or not. And so we did it, and we went and did the best we could with it. Well, he was right. The song was a huge hit.
Do you like it any better now?
Nope. No, George really was a real good teacher for me. He was the one that told me, you have a high-sounding voice, almost, you know, like a girl. I want you to utilize that. And he said, I have a natural lisp. You know, my tongue gets tied there. And he liked that. He thought it was great. And he sort of emphasized that, and he got me to enunciate my words. And he told me, I'll never forget that, he says, just like Nat King Cole. Now, it just happened that Nat King Cole was my idol. So I turned the words, you don't remember me. Everything was pronounced with this great diction. you gotta deal with this, you know, kid from Brooklyn. And in those days, man, rock and roll, the Stone Ages of rock and roll, nobody was singing anything that anybody could understand. We were a natural. We had to hit, man. We had to make it. I come out there with this, "You don't remember me? 'Twas not so long ago." You know, I sound like some British kid, you know? Well, it worked.
The production changed in the records you did. In the 1960s, songs like Hurt So Bad and Going Out of My Head.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like, great arrangements behind you. Strings, French horns, timpani.
I'm glad you ask. I'm glad you mentioned that. You see, there are two Little Anthony and the Imperials here. The first Little Anthony Imperials in 1958 really came out of the New York area. We were just a ram-a-lam-a, bing-bang, rob-a-dob-a-dee-dam, shimmy-shimmy, coca-bop type group. And that was great. But then you grow.
I know you don't know what I'm going through. Standing here looking at you. She's in love, don't stand in her way. But let me tell you that it hurts so bad. It makes me feel so sad. It's gonna hurt so bad if you walk away. Why don't you stay and let me make it up to you? Anything you want me to. You loved me before, please love me again. I can't let you go back to him.
Please don't go, please don't go. So
did you like having those big arrangements behind you?
Absolutely, yes, because you know why? I can truthfully say there is not many, if not at all, anybody you can possibly think of at that time was doing anything like that. And I realized then that I knew how to sing, and I knew that I was going to be better. I was going to become a better singer. It became serious to me.
Did it change the kind of material you wanted?
Absolutely. If you look at all the material after that, it was all different.
Different in what way?
Oh, it was sophisticated. We were into four-part modern harmony, doing things like the Hilos were doing and the Freshmen. We were doing jazz. We were doing things that no group from Brooklyn or New York City would ever think of going or even trying to even attempt to do. We were way ahead of our time.
Now, I think I remember you doing splits and things like that in the rock and roll
shows. We were a high-energy group also,
yeah.
Yes. We're a high-energy group. We were out of the same mold as the Flamingos and the Traineers and those kind of groups. We just took a little of everything. We got smitten, so to speak, with show business. We ended up with William Morris, and they began to open doors for us in Vegas and Lake Tahoe and Reno. We started playing the great hotels, the great rooms. You just cannot imagine. That was a wonderful time in my career.
Now, a lot of people really didn't want to go from rock and roll or rhythm and blues into the Vegas lounges, but there was a period where it was the only place to go if you wanted to make more money and go to the next step.
Yeah. I don't think it's so much that they didn't want to go, rather than they didn't have the material or the show or the act to go. I mean, you just don't go to them and say, "Hey, I'm going to go in your lounge." There's a certain type of audience that was in those lounges, you know? They've seen them all. I mean, these people have seen every great performer in the world came through those lounges. You can't go in there ram-a-lam-a-ding-dong. You have to be able to perform at a high, high level. And I think a lot of them were scared and didn't seek it.
You said that you've had to play every single kind of place imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
You spent a lot of time in the Vegas lounges, but I think you also played a lot of places on the road that weren't quite a swank, where you'd even have to maybe threaten the person to get your money that you were owed.
Oh, yeah, everybody did. We weren't unique. That's chauvinist, man. That goes mm-hmm. back in the first court jester came out with some little beads or something and balls on his head and jumped around and somebody ripped him off or something, you know, the king, the court jester. Now, that's the norm. Yeah, let me give you a little story that I'm going to make it brief, but it just blew my mind. We, in 1975, got to the point that we worked the Waldorf Astoria, now one of the most prestigious rooms in the world in the Waldorf Astoria. We got one, the Imperials and I got one of the best write-ups from the critics in town you can ever, ever want in that day. The next week after we left the Waldorf, we were over in Jersey at Jimmy's Bar and Grill, you know what I mean? What a disastrous contrast. I mean, sitting over a smoke-filled thing with a bunch of guys with cigars blowing in your face, you know, with waiters coming past you, man, with, you know, with food in the hand and plates dropping all over the place and fights in the back. Oh, we knew it was that was the end.
So what do you want to happen next with your career now?
I want, in my career, I want to be the best that I can be as a performer. I think that I'm a better singer and a performer than I've ever been in my whole career now. Now, ask me why, I am not really sure. I've always been a late bloomer. I didn't even shave till I was 35 years old. I mean, who knows what that is? Maybe it's genes. I don't know why. I feel I am as comparable and I could be as mainstream a recording artist as anybody today. Now, that sounds very egotistical. Well, I mean it to be that way. I mean it to be that way in case record people hear this thing. I will tell you, you're blowing it. I'm good. I'm real good. I'm a pro. I know what I'm doing as a singer.
You want to record again?
I want to record again, and there's no reason why I shouldn't be. Absolutely no reason at all.
What is the reason why you haven't been?
Political. Politics. It's a youth-orientated market, and there are a lot of people in recording, you know, they have their problems, man. You know, they have to keep that stuff going out there and getting hits. It's competitive, you know? I understand their problems, but listen, the same thing happened with Tina Turner, bless her heart. See? Nobody saw her. Nobody knew. She was comparable. She was able to hold her own, and they found her. Bang, you know? I say that because I want them to know that I think that I can hold my own.
Anthony, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Little Anthony is performing at the Ballroom in New York through April 8th.
I'm on the outside looking in, and I want to be, and I want to be back on the inside with you. You are with somebody new.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, are you following the election results in El Salvador?
We are, Terry. Tom Jelton is in San Salvador, and he'll be reporting on what now does appear to be a victory by the candidate of the right-wing Arena Party. We'll also be hearing from Ann Cooper in Moscow about the growing popularity of Boris Yeltsin. Remember, Yeltsin was the Communist Party leader of Moscow, who was stripped of his post there and on the Politburo. Now he's a candidate for the legislature, and thousands of people turned out to demonstrate for him the other day. Also, an interview with folk singer Michelle Schacht, who admits it is a contradiction to be a professional folk singer, and psychiatrist Daryl Treffert about extraordinary people, autistic savants.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A television classic is returning to TV this week, the 1960 broadcast of Peter Pan, starring Mary Martin. Television critic David Bianculli welcomes it back.
I'm flying.
Flying.
Over bed, over chair, duck your head, clear the air. Oh, what lovely fun. Watch me, everyone. Take a look at me and see how easily it's done.
The sound is a little ragged in spots, but that's understandable. This videotape of Peter Pan, which NBC is broadcasting this Friday, is almost 30 years old. But the magic is still there, and there isn't a kid in America, or a parent, who won't enjoy watching Mary Martin fly through the air. James Barry's durable fairy tale, and with Tinkerbell along, it's a real fairy tale, was filmed as a silent movie in 1925, animated by Walt Disney in 1953, and staged for Broadway and TV in the 50s and again in the 70s. Parts of it are on stage again right now in a show-stopping segment of Jerome Robbins' Broadway. But the TV show on NBC this week is the original article. Peter Pan was the first Broadway hit to be presented intact on television. It was performed live on TV in 1955 and again in 1956 with Mary Martin as Peter Pan, Cyril Richard as Captain Hook, and a beam of light as Tinkerbell. After that, somebody had the brilliant idea to use this new invention called videotape. The cast was called back one more time to make a taped version, in color, that premiered in 1960. That Peter Pan was shown again three times, but the last time was in 1973, 16 years ago. You have to be an adult then to remember the songs and joys from this version of Peter Pan, but you don't have to be an adult to enjoy them. Listen.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
If growing up means it would be beneath my dignity to climb a tree, I'll never grow up, never grow up, never grow up. Not me.
We'll
send
for Tiger Lily.
We'll send
for Peter Pan.
We'll come and willy-nilly, lily. Send up a flag, and I'll be there. You know you really got a friend.
A friend.
We'll be true blood brothers to the end.
Who's the creepiest creep in the world?
Captain Hook! Captain Hook!
Who's dispensable?
You.
Reprehensible?
You.
Whose behavior is quite indefensible?
You.
Who's the crawlingest, cruelest, crummiest, crookedest crook?
Crookedest crook!
In the end of Peter Pan, the ageless hero comes back to visit Wendy, but finds that Wendy is a generation older, so he charms her child instead. That's exactly what's happening with this NBC special. I saw it in 1960 when I was 7 years old. My diary entry for December 8th says, "Was Peter Pan good today?" Now I've shown Peter Pan to my own children, who are 6 and 4, and they love it just as much as I did. Like me, they clapped 2 times, once when Peter asked them to, and once when it was over.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
If you believe, wherever you are, clap your hands, and she'll hear you. Clap! Clap! Don't let Teak die! Clap! She's getting better. Clap! She's getting stronger. Oh, she's all well now. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And now I'll rescue Wendy.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Lyle Lovett's singles have made it onto the country charts, but his acerbic lyrics, big band sound, and eraserhead hairdo make him something of an oddball in the country music world. Next time, Lyle Lovett plays and talks about his songs. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, a British band which preceded the British invasion. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Irving's new novel. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.